You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Hey, everyone. If you haven't done so already, please give us a quick rating and review on Apple Podcasts. That, more than anything, will help us keep producing new episodes. And for early, ad-free, and bonus episodes, you can become a paid subscriber, either directly on Apple Podcasts or at patreon.com/subtextpodcast.
Okay, welcome to part four of our discussion of Rime of the Ancient Mariner. We just got done introducing Death and what presumably is Mrs. Death, although that may be a misreading.
Classic couple.
For all we know, she could be his daughter, or they may not even be related, but they may just work together.
Their work husband and wife, yeah.
In any case, we should see what Death in Life turns out to be. Mrs. Death or Death in Life turns out to be the more important personage, in the sense of that what comes now will be, or the Mariner will be, life in death as opposed to death, because she's the one who won the dice game. So do you want to read on and tell us what that looks like?
Yeah, let's do it. Okay. With never a whisper in the sea, off darts the specter ship, while clomb above the eastern bar, the horned moon with one bright star almost atween the tips. One after one by the horned moon, listen, O stranger, to me, each turned his face with a ghastly pang and cursed me with his E. 40 living men, with never a sigh or groan, with heavy thump, a lifeless lump, they dropped down one by one. Their souls did from their bodies fly, they fled to bliss or woe, and every soul it passed me by like the whiz of my crossbow. Okay.
So I guess the stranger, his attention is wandering at this point. Surprising, given how cool Death and Mrs. Death are, but he gets a little slap in the face here. Pay attention.
It's interesting that this condemnation to death does not extend to any kind of condemning to eternal damnation, say. Each one gets his own, is sent in his own direction, right? Some are going to bliss, so some are going to heaven, and some are going to woe or hell. But, you know, regardless, they're all dead.
And they're all passing by him. Each soul goes by him like the whiz of his crossbow. So they, each flight of each soul recapitulates the killing of the albatross, in a sense.
Yeah, so it's kind of this, you know, the sailors have been kind of one mass, if you will. You know, the Mariner is the only one set apart, and otherwise they all seem to have a singular kind of consciousness, which, you know, interprets events as a fairly uniform body. I think the only indication of some individuals within this horde prior to this are some people who are having these dreams of the spirit that's followed them from the land of mist and snow, right? Some in dreams assured were. So I just think it's interesting that we have these 200 men just all dropping dead simultaneously, as if, again, as if they're all one singular body. And yet the particularity of the fact that these are individuals going to their individual fates, and that each one has the, as you're pointing out, the weight of the singular albatross. It's a very interesting distinction to make at this point, that they seem most particularized in death, in this in this collective fate.
And then later on, they'll seem to become zombies, right?
Yeah, and they have no...
So it's a little confusing what's animating them as they are...
Right, right.
Zombie creatures running the ship. But also, oddly enough, the Spectre ship just leaves, darts off. Also, it is kind of weird that if Death in Life wins the bet, that the bulk of the winnings go to Death. She won the dice game, but he gets 99% of the winnings.
Right.
Of the pot, so to speak. So, very strange. Through the holes of his eyes and the hole of his mouth, half whistles and half groans. What an image.
That's great.
All right. So, what's next?
Okay.
They'll die.
Part four. Part four begins with quotation marks. Here we go. I fear thee, ancient mariner. I fear thy skinny hand, and thou art long and lank and brown, as is the ribbed sea sand. I fear thee and thy glittering eye, and thy skinny hand so brown. Fear not, thou wedding guest. This body dropped not down. Alone, alone, all alone, alone on the wide, wide sea. And Christ would take no pity on my soul in agony. The many men so beautiful, and they all dead did lie. and a million, million slimy things lived on, and so did I. I looked upon the rotting sea and drew my eyes away. I looked upon the eldritch deck, and there the dead men lay. I looked to heaven and tried to pray, but or ever a prayer had gushed, a wicked whisper came and made my heart as dry as dust. I closed my lids and kept them closed till the balls like pulses beat, for the sky and the sea and the sky lay like a load on my weary eye, and the dead were at my feet.
So we finally get a reaction out of the wedding guest.
Yeah.
Stop scaring me.
Who previously was maybe not totally paying attention is now afraid and rapt again after just a couple more stanzas. I guess, you know, the payoff is, or the high point is all these people dropping dead. So now he's back in it. But yeah, so he fears the mariner, you know, in this interesting interjection, he fears the mariner the way the mariner feared the ghostly figures on the ship. And again, like I'm, you know, I'm drawing a connection here between the way the mariner looks and the way death seems to look. You know, I'm reminded of so many stories. I grew up being really interested in old ships and particularly in like whaling expeditions and things like this. But anyway, I always loved stories of tall ships and expeditions and things like that. And very often what you'll read in these accounts of real life instances in which people were shipwrecked and nearly starved to death is that usually for the rest of their lives, their body like never makes up for the loss of nutrition that they had for however many days they might have been out at sea, right? Oftentimes they'll eat and eat and eat and still always be underweight for the rest of their lives. At least this is what was reported, you know, back in the 19th century by their contemporaries.
There's a huge, huge dieting fad in the 19th century. The sea hand diet. Just go out and do some time on a ship.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. No, but
come back and
It's being called to mind here in terms of like the, you know, both the appearance of the mariner, and he does seem like he's not put on much weight since this event, but also in the kind of, you know, the rapaciousness of the person who's gone through the experience. And, you know, here it's coming out in the compulsion to tell the story and in this sort of like heightened emotion, right? But this desire to continually relive it, or rather like someone who hasn't moved beyond the event.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So he doesn't like the mariner. He doesn't like a skinny hand. He doesn't like the tan. It's kind of tan that
he's
you can
jealous.
Only get by being at sea for a long time.
Right.
And he doesn't like that glittering eye. In a way, it sounds like, so he's telling the mariner, you look like you're dead, or maybe you look like you're a mummy, which is what the tanning and is kind of evocative of. And then the mariner says, don't worry, I'm not actually dead.
Right, right.
Everyone else died, but I had this special death in life role to play.
Mm-hmm.
So let me just continue telling my story.
Right.
That's reassuring. That's really reassuring. So he's going to continue to force feed him this really disturbing story in which he now compares himself to the other million, million slimy things that they live on. So does he.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it sounded as if they might be maggot-like from the rots of the deep. And does he have a maggot role as well? I don't know.
Mm.
But he tries to pray. But again, the this idea of the drought and thirst, which is, it's been used figuratively a few times, comes back. And he had to drink his own blood to communicate with the crew earlier, and now he can't even pray. He's too dried out, and maybe that's the way he looks to the wedding guest. He looks
like jerky.
If he is looking mummy like, yeah, like jerky, he looks dried out. He's not hydrating enough is what I'm trying to say. If you're gonna do the sea hand diet, it's very important you stay hydrated.
That's right.
Even if there's water all around and not a drop to drink, you bring your own bottled water on the trip with you. It's clearly stated in the guidelines. But anyway,
well,
yes.
Then how do you lose all the water
spiritually? That's true. He's not spiritually hydrated. He can't pray. So you get this, you know, the continuing irony of there being water everywhere, but things, but drought, there being a drought, physical and spiritual, that prevents communication, prevents prayer.
Yeah.
That's, I don't know what makes your eye glitter like that other than just complete insanity.
But. I think that's it. Yeah. I like this. Spiritual dehydration. you know, I spent some time with the stanza thinking about why a prayer can't gush from him. And whenever he tries to, a wicked whisper comes up instead, and wondering what that whisper might be, you know, what sort of, like, what would he be saying, a curse instead of a prayer, you know, taking the Lord's name in vain or something like that, rather than crying out to God. You know, I think that there are a lot of potential interpretations for this inability to pray. He says, you know, Christ would take no pity on my soul. So, you know, presumably pity would be having gone with death rather than death's wife dying or somehow being relieved of this suffering. So he's, you know, he's kind of a Job figure, and rather than, you know, continuing to handle this with a certain forbearance, right, he's potentially kind of angry and alone now. And so anyway, it's you know, this spiritual dehydration seems to be related to the fact that he is still, he still hasn't learned his lesson, perhaps, or he's not redeemed yet. And so I'm just curious about what that wicked whisper might be. I mean, you know, we don't, there's a suggestion perhaps that we'll get it a little bit. Do we get it later? Does he say something? No, I'm thinking of something else.
Well, it's interesting because the whisper makes his heart as dry as dust, when you would expect the causality to run the other way.
Mm-hmm.
His heart is dry, and therefore he produces a whisper instead of a gush. So that's one interesting aspect of the image. We know he's alone because it's repeated several times, and presumably not just to make meter, right? Alone, alone, all alone, alone.
Right.
Are you really alone if you're alone four times? It seems like after a certain point, you've got company. At least you have the company of all the dead men on the deck. So
Eldritch deck.
He's alone as many times as there are dead men.
Mm-hmm.
Presumably the aloneness has something to do with this state of being able to pray properly. And as we've already mentioned, there's a sense in which he was alone even before all these this began, and identified with the aloneness of the albatross.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps. I like the image of the sky and the sea kind of laying on his eyes, or his weary eye, like a load, like a bearing down on it. They have pressure.
Mm-hmm.
Such that, you know, the static image of the painted boat and the painted sea, there's a dynamism to it. It can be oppressive to the eye.
Mm-hmm. Should I keep reading?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sure.
The cold sweat melted from their limbs. No rot, no reek did they. The look with which they looked on me had never passed away. An orphan's curse would drag to hell a spirit from on high. But oh, more horrible than that is the curse in a dead man's eye. 7 days, 7 nights I saw that curse, and yet I could not die. The moving moon went up the sky, and nowhere did abide. Softly she was going up, and a star or two beside. Her beams bemocked the sultry main, like morning frosts. Y spread.
Come on, Coleridge. This is getting a little bit ridiculous.
Like morning frosty spread. But where the ship's huge shadow lay, the charmed water burnt alway a still and awful red. Beyond the shadow of the ship, I watched the water snakes. They moved in tracks of shining white, and when they reared, the elfish light fell off in hoary flakes. Within the shadow of the ship, I watched their rich attire. Blue, glossy green, and velvet black, they coiled and swam, and every track was a flash of golden fire. Oh, happy living things, no tongue their beauty might declare. A spring of love gushed from my heart, and I blessed them unaware. Sure, my kind saint took pity on me, and I blessed them unaware. The selfsame moment I could pray, and from my neck so free, the albatross fell off and sank like lead into the sea.
Well, that was okay. Quick.
It was quick.
All right.
Quick
turnaround. He was redeemed pretty quickly.
well, it took a week.
is that what it says?
7 days, 7 nights.
Oh, 7 days, 7 nights.
Yeah.
Alone, 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 alone. Day after day after day after day. then orphan's curse would drag to hell a spirit from on high. Really?
Mm.
Orphans have that much power?
Yeah, God. Even more horrible than suffer. An orphan. Is the curse in a dead man's eye?
Is a dead man slightly?
You think, and especially like a ginger orphan, like little Orphan Annie, even more horrible than her. It is, yeah.
The sun will come out tomorrow.
Oh, no.
But there won't be any water to drink. It'd be great to see that song performed on the ship with the dead mariners dancing like a Michael Jackson.
There you go.
Thriller video. Doing it to a hard knock. It's a hard knock life.
Yeah. Their bones clanking around. A little tap number. It's great.
So the curse in the dead man's eye, a bit evocative of the glinting eye of the mariner as he's relating the tale. Maybe I might be stretching it a bit there.
Mm.
In the meantime, the beams of the sun, the moon in parallel, it seems, to the curse coming from the eyes, is bemocking the sultry main. Ooh, sultry. The ship is sultry. Is the main the mast? It's the main mast, right?
Yeah.
Why is it sultry?
Well, because
everything's supposed to be dry.
Well, where the moon colors the sea, it's white, right? But where the shadow of the ship lies, the water is red. So the sultry is the redness, is it?
Hmm.
So that's why that it bemocked the sultry main. So, you know, this is image almost of like blood in the water. You know, is the shadow of the ship. I think that's why it's sultry. Maybe I'm reading this wrong.
Well, I'm thinking heat and humidity, mm-hmm. something like that. It's not unheard of for it to have a sexual connotation. Are we getting any of that here? I don't know.
The moon is a woman, but otherwise I don't. It's in contrast to the sultry, maybe the purity of the moon. I mean, there's a respite here, right, from the
yes, this is, I think you're spot on here.
Okay.
Yes. The purity of the moon is what mocks the sultriness of the main. The sinful. Bad main. Bad ship.
Well, there's also, I think, this punitive quality to the sun is relaxed with the more ameliorative moon. So, you know, one is put in mind of Marian implications. You know, Mary is the intercessor for her son, Christ, who can be more of an administrator, I'm sorry, of an administer of justice, perhaps, right? So there's something pure, but also rather, I think, gentle and more maternal about this moon, which, you know, the purity of the moon and the connection to Mary would, you know, connect those two ideas pretty well, I think, if we want to look at it that way. Yeah, so she's coming in, she's interceding, and her intercession seems to be what then induces the mariner to find the water snakes now beautiful in this softer light, and this seems to be what allows his conversion of sorts.
So all he had to do is change his perspective. Yeah, I guess so. The water burnt all way. The water is burning. I guess that would make things sultry.
Mm.
And it remains that way. Remains red even as the moon frosts up, so to speak, cools down the ship. But I presume now that he's looking at the water snakes, which we had read, you know, at some point it seemed like they had legs maybe, and there might be maggot-like because they're coming from a rotting deep.
Mm-hmm.
Presumably, he's looking still at the burning water, whether that's just, you know, the way it looks or what's actually happening. But when they reared, the elfish light fell off in hoary flakes.
Mm.
They're leaving tracks of shining white. It's as if now they are sort of agents of the moon, right? And they're having the same cooling effect,
mm-hmm.
at least when it comes to the light. Light comes off them as if they're shedding pieces of skin. You know, one of the most interesting parts of the poem is the oddness of this imagery, right? It's not just surreal. It's quite, I guess surreal is the right word, but it's not just dreamlike. It's quite out of the ordinary.
This cooling effect, you know, I think that in a way we're returned spiritually, if you will, to the scene of the crime, right? So the hoary flakes are, you know, like snow, right? So we're almost in the middle of this sultry ocean at the equator, were being returned to these Antarctic conditions, you know, for his transformation to be, his sort of spiritual transformation to be affected. And I think that there's, you know, there's something too in the following stanza that is a mirror of the witch's oils. So, you know, the water snakes are described as blue, glossy green, and velvet black, right prior the psychedelic, I think was the word you used, for the waters like the witch's oils at the equator, which burnt green and blue and white. But here they're described as being like attire. So it's almost, you know, the velvet black is like they have, you know, rather heavy clothing on, which would be indicative of a colder place. So these water snakes are going to turn out to affect his redemption, or, you know, whatever we want to call it, not to put too fine a point on that. But I think for that reason, we have to get this gust of cold air, this reprieve, and this, you know, as I already said, this return to, you know, the conditions in which he killed the albatross.
Let's take a moment to talk about our sponsor for today's episode, HelloFresh. With HelloFresh, you get farm-fresh, pre-portioned ingredients and seasonal recipes delivered right to your doorstep. Skip trips to the grocery store and count on HelloFresh to make home cooking easy, fun, and affordable. That's why it's America's number one meal kit. Make restaurant-quality meals at home without the high cost of takeout. Plus, HelloFresh's new Ready in 20 recipes are on the table in just 20 minutes. That's even quicker than delivery. HelloFresh is really convenient. You just choose your meals and select a delivery date. HelloFresh handles all the meal planning, shopping, and most of the prep, so all you have to do is open your box and get cooking. That includes balanced, fit, and wholesome recipes, chock full of fresh produce, and under 650 calories per serving. My experience with HelloFresh has been great. I cook way more using HelloFresh than I am when I'm not using it. That's because I'm far more inclined just to do takeout or delivery rather than meal plan, go to the grocery store, get all the fresh ingredients, do the prep work, do the cooking. I might have done that sometimes, but not on the same consistent basis. HelloFresh made it much easier to consistently prepare healthier, fresh meals for myself. Some of my favorite recipes include hearty steak and potatoes, balsamic chicken rustico, and lemony shrimp risotto. Go to HelloFresh.com/subtextsweet for free dessert for life. One dessert item per box while subscription is active. That's free dessert for life at HelloFresh.com/subtextsweet. That's HelloFresh, America's number one meal kit. Okay, back to the show. Yeah, it's interesting because when they broke into the static realm, we speculated that that might have something to do with the aesthetic, at least the Apollonian aesthetic. And here he discovers for the first time, I guess, the beauty of the things that he thought were a kind of rotting. We had moved from aesthetic stasis to death to rot, which reintroduced dynamism, and then to this, the spirit that's been pursuing them under the water. And now we've made a transition to the idea that there could be something beautiful in what seemed to be a rotting. So, and that, as you've pointed out, is his redemption, the ability to see that beauty where he only saw terror, and that's the thing that frees him up to be able to pray again. It spiritually hydrates him, so to speak. Mm-hmm. He can now actually speak in more than a whisper. The albatross falls off like lead into the sea.
Yeah, but
great image. Great. You know, it conveys the heaviness of it. You know, this continues to suggest that his problem involves his relationship to the natural world, and in particular to living things, to other creatures, and maybe to the concept of creaturehood in general, which would also explain his relationship to marriage. Maybe it's a relationship to propagation, right?
Mm-hmm.
Maggots coming from rot are like propagation, according to a pre-scientific theory. Spontaneous generation would be sexless generation of life.
Mm-hmm. That's a great point. I just wanted to, you know, I figured I'd be remiss if I didn't point out that he blesses the water snakes unaware. Right. So this is what makes this poem so frustratingly complicated, is that, you know, seemingly just as unmotivated as his shooting of the albatross was, he's also not really responsible for even for his moment of redemption. You know, I don't want to say.
Yeah, I think you're spot on here. Go ahead.
Yeah. No, I don't want to say that this is a poem that's sort of like anti free will. But it might be. I don't know.
Yeah. No, I think you're spot on. I hadn't thought of this. Yeah, this moment where he blesses them unaware, this is directly parallel to the lack of awareness with which he shoots the albatross. I don't know that he describes his, when he shoots the albatross, he just says, "And I just went ahead and shot the albatross." So I think he doesn't say I was, I shot it unaware, but it comes across that way.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this has to, Coleridge is purposefully juxtaposing these two moments. The thing that gets him in trouble and the thing that gets him out of trouble are very similar. He's shooting from the hip in a sense.
Well, and there's a kind
of... So I can see why you would think that maybe this implicates a lack of free will, or he's acting from the unconscious, although I guess you could suppose at this point he's acting out of grace, maybe.
Right. But either way, I think, what this highlights is, if you like, a kind of capriciousness to his internal weather, right? Like if he is, you know, an extension of the natural landscape, which can turn on a dime and, you know, and suddenly decide to make you feel as though you're being persecuted, as if there's a kind of a thought behind it, but really there isn't, in spite of this desire for mastery over it or for separation or, you know, whatever motivated the killing of the albatross. You know, he's just as much a part of nature as the weather is, or any of these other, or the water snakes, mm-hmm. or the albatross, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Makes sense. Shall we do one more section?
Sure. And now we're into section 5. O sleep, it is a gentle thing, beloved from pole to pole. To Mary Queen the praise be Yevon. She sent the gentle sleep from heaven that slid into my soul. The silly...
What is this, like a Robert Burns poem? I mean,
yeah, exactly. The silly buckets on the deck that had so long remained, I dreamt that they were filled with dew, and when I awoke, it rained. My lips were wet, my throat was cold, my garments all were dank. Sure, I had drunken in my dreams, and still my body drank. I moved and could not feel my limbs. I was so light, almost, I thought that I had died in sleep and was a blessed ghost. The roaring wind, it roared far off. It did not come anear, but with its sound it shook the sails that were so thin and sere. The upper air burst into life, and 100 fire flags sheen. To and fro they are hurried about, and to and fro and in and out the stars dance on between. The coming wind doth roar more loud, the sails do sigh like sedge. The rain pours down from one black cloud, and the moon is at its edge. I'll do one more. Hark, hark, yeah. The thick black cloud is cleft, and the moon is at its side. Like waters shot from some high crag, the lightning falls with never a jag, a river steep and wide.
Yes, the dead men are about to get up.
About to.
Yeah, so what's going on here?
I mean,
praise be Yevon.
Yeah, praise be Yevon.
Mary Queen, praise be you, to you even, Yevon, yeah, what is it?
I don't know. I think it's supposed to be given to you.
Oh,
praise
okay.
be given.
Well, you could have just said that.
No, it doesn't rhyme with heaven. Well, I guess it does, but not enough for him.
She could just put a G instead of a Y. Praise be Gavin.
Gavin. Praise be Gavin. Mary loves people named Gavin. That's his name.
Lots of fun we do be having. Sorry.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. So we have a direct invocation of Mary. So I wasn't too far off, I think, with this moon thing. Moon Mary connection. But anyway, but then we have these buckets. I love this, the silly buckets on the deck, which is ridiculous. It's glossed in my edition as simple or homely. So they're filled up with this dew is what he's dreaming, and then when he wakes up he realizes that it's raining and they're filling up these buckets. And of course, like, I'm thinking of the mariner as a vessel for these natural forces, right? He too is being filled up like the bucket, but also it seems like he's been filled with grace at the right moment and is now receiving his redemptive kind of
hydration.
Reward. Yeah, hydration. The albatross then, you know, just prior to this having fallen off of him, you know, the suggestion here is that the albatross both marked or cursed and kind of blessed him at the same time. So now he's gotten rid of this burden. He's, you know, if he's a Christ figure, then the sleep is like a death. And in a way, this rain and this replenishment or this hydration, right, is like being reborn or being rather resurrected, right?
Yeah, that's what it seems to be. The dead men are going to get a different kind of resurrection, right?
That's right. Should I keep reading?
These straight up zombies. Yeah, do it.
Yeah. So he thought he had died and thought he was a ghost. But in fact, he's just truly resurrected. And then there's a wind that's coming. The black cloud parts And then we have this moment. The strong wind reached the ship. It roared and dropped down like a stone. Beneath the lightning and the moon, the dead men gave a groan. They groaned, they stirred, they all uprose. No spake, no moved their eyes. It had been strange, even in a dream, to have seen those dead men rise. The helmsman steered, the ship moved on, yet never a breeze up blew. The mariners all again worked the ropes, where they were wont to do. They raised their limbs like lifeless tools. We were a ghastly crew. The body of my brother's son stood by me knee to knee. The body and I pulled at one rope, but he said not to me. And I quaked to think of my own voice, how frightful it would be. The daylight dawned. They dropped their arms and clustered round the mast. Sweet sounds rose slowly through their mouths and from their bodies passed. Around, around flew each sweet sound, then darted to the sun. Slowly the sounds came back again, now mixed, now one by one. This was Wordsworth's idea that he gave himself credit for, right? This idea that the bodies of the crew would be reanimated to get the ship back where it belonged. Am I right for, okay, remembering that correctly?
I think so. Yeah. I know he gave himself credit for something, and that sounds right. Well, he gave himself credit for a few things.
You know, I don't know that I love this point. This is the point at which I think, okay, you know, this is the really unbelievable part.
Plot hole. Right? We're supposed to believe this.
I liked the whole, you know, death and life and death thing, but this is just a bridge too far. No, but there's, you know, there's something.
Well,
being
is it consistent?
Here.
You know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. This is what I mean.
I mean, their spirits have already shot off, like his bow.
Right.
And like an arrow from his bow. And yeah.
It does seem like this is just one too many complications in this. In a poem that's already kind of overburdened with various forms of, you know, immortal and mortal complications. But, you know, so we have the rain and then we have this like big storm coming. And now we have, again, we have something approaching, which is very similar to the undead ship. It's one too many reanimations, one too many, you know, I was almost dead and then I came back to life kind of twists and turns here. And this is supposed to be like a good thing, I guess, because this is how he gets back home. He needs the whole crew to run the ship. Otherwise, I suppose it would have been too unbelievable for him to get all the way home on a ship that big with a crew of one. So this is how they, you know, how presumably Wordsworth suggested they fix the plot hole. Is that right?
Interesting.
I'm assuming, right? Because otherwise people would say, well, I don't believe that. How could he get home? Just one guy on a ship. That's the thing they would critique the realism of.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, we get another paradoxical image. There are lots of them in here. The strong wind dropping like a stone. And it seems to be the thing that reanimates the dead men. It's as if the wind becomes their spirit. Mm-hmm. And, you know, later on, the helmsman is steering. Never a breeze up blew. So the wind, a strong wind comes, instead of just blowing the ship normally, which would be plausible, right? That would be the plausible way, even if he's the only one left. Yeah, I think he could do it if he has a wind. Instead, the wind comes, reanimates the men, and then it's gone. And then the ship moves without the wind, mm-hmm. but with the crew.
Right.
I guess you need the crew more than you need the wind. Or they're their own wind. If they've been reanimated by the wind, the crew, in some sense, are the wind. So maybe we could see that as a kind of fusion of the agency of the crew members with the natural elements on which they are usually dependent, as on chance or fate, but for movement. So they become their own source of movement here.
Well, I like this because you're kind of submerging within the crew, like the two things that we actually do need to make the ship go, right? The ship, in a way, is like a clockwork mechanism or something like that. But at the same time, right, it's also like dependent on wind and something that's extremely natural. So it's like these two sort of semi-opposed forces coalescing in order to get the ship to move. And so here, I think you're suggesting that this is like combined within these reanimated bodies. So we have them, you know, working the ropes, which is almost like, you know, the wind working them or the crew members, you know, it could kind of go either way in that. Well, I suppose it says the mariners all again worked the ropes. This is the first time, is it, that the sailors are referred to as mariners? or am I?
Yeah, I think so. I think the only other reference to is when the wedding guest calls him a marinare.
Right.
Marinare.
Right. Yeah. So the crew, they're called the crew. They're called, I don't know. I suppose I've been referring to them as sailors to distinguish them from the mariner, but maybe that's just my own distinction. Certainly they're called the crew, right? And so here, that's interesting. Here they're all mariners. We are all the crew
and
of
his
the
nephew,
Enterprise.
His nephew's along for the ride, and that's the first time we
learn
that. I don't know what this little stanza is doing. He's the other than for shock value.
Well, it's very...
My brother's son is, yeah.
Yeah, it's very strange. The brother's son, you know, gets this individualized shout out, but then he becomes the body and I pulled at one rope.
Yes, spooky.
Yeah. So I don't know what that's supposed to do. It's supposed to show what?
I think it's just supposed to be spooky and creepy.
Well, it's not just the body of my brother, but my brother's son. So there's something here about, right, about, I don't know, the extreme unnaturalness of the fact that, like, he's, you know, the younger generation has also died in this melee. But we're learning this too late, you know, if there was a little boy.
Yeah, and I don't. You're right.
Was dying.
Is it a little boy?
Yeah.
Or is it,
yeah.
But yeah, I see it as a little bit gratuitous. But then the interesting part here is, you know, so the nephew says nothing, and then the nephew says not to me, and I quake to think of my own voice, how frightful it would be.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an interesting reversal. The idea that he's the one who's frightening, he, the living one, would be frightening to the dead.
Yeah.
That's inventive.
And also that. Certainly, but also that, you know, his sort of like surprise that this reanimated corpse is not speaking to him supersedes his own lack of speech towards this, right? If anyone would be talking, like, hey, who are you? What's going on here? Presumably it would be the one who's actually alive, right? And so instead, what we kind of get by the end of the sentence is the knowledge that neither is saying anything to the other. They're both not speaking.
From the perspective of the dead, they probably, I think the supposition is that they would assume he's just one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, we're all just dead men manning this boat.
Right.
Nothing out of the ordinary about that.
We've been drafted by the wind.
To speak, yeah. What the hell is this? There's a living guy on board? Yeah. What the hell?
Get him.
That's weird. That's scary. So you get this reversal of perspectives where the dead might look upon the living as their own sort of haunting or weirdness or being out of place.
Mm. The mariner, our mariner, joins in, you know, but they have a very specific purpose here. Seems they, you know, they get right to work. their limbs like lifeless tools, you know, they're purely there to do it one last job before they're, and that's the other thing is that they all were off to heaven or hell. So I guess they've been recalled.
It's just such an inconsistency. I don't know how you have a look at it, but they will make now sweet sounds. There was a point right in the poem when they were alive, when no one could speak because they were just so thirsty.
Yes.
And now, presumably, they don't speak because they're dead, even though they can man the boat. But they can emit these sweet sounds, which then seem to take upon a life of their own. Fly around, dart to the sun. So we get another darting. They've already darted, you know, the spirit's already darted out.
Right, right.
Now they're producing sweet sounds, which dart, then come back and mix.
Yeah, and this does remind me of the whistling and groaning that come through the holes of the eyes and mouth of death.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But this seems better because they're sweet sounds. So, and then.
Right. Back then it was creepy and terrible.
Right. Now it's just the.
Now it's all good.
The sounds of spirits once again departing from zombie bodies. So this is much sweeter.
It's like a tin whistle now.
yeah.
Before it was more like someone with a chipped tooth kind of whistling. Now it's more like a melodic recorder or a tin whistle.
Well, and this is going to be interpolated with birdsong, right? In a second. So,
right.
And potentially the idea that he's now back home, or he's near shore, right? So let me read a few more stanzas here.
Well, I think we're out of time.
Oh, actually. Are we? Okay. Well, then that's just a preview of of the next few stanzas.
Yes. I think, yes, we've gotten to a point where we can get through this in one more recording.
Or two more episodes,
that will be, two more parts, one more recording, two more parts. That'll be parts 5 and 6. We will finish this up. But for now, we must say farewell. What would the mariner say?
I think they'd say...
Not adieu.
That's not a sweet sound. They would say...
Not ahoy.
Don't yeven the door on the way out. No, that's not... say something like, don't curse me with your E if it's all the same to me. And okay.
How does a sailor say good night or goodbye? Is there a specific sailor term for that?
Hi ho. No, those are miners.
Godspeed.
Godspeed. Or... Fare ye well. Ahoy is hello. Well. So I don't know.
Yeah. Like, what's the opposite of ahoy?
I know. Ahoy isn't like aloha, where it can mean hello and goodbye, huh?
Right.
Too bad. It's almost the same letters, but very different terms.
Okay. All right. Well, till next time.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye.
And thanks to everyone who listened. Just a reminder that if you haven't done so already, please give us a quick rating and review on Apple Podcasts. That, more than anything, will help us keep producing new episodes. For an easy way to do that, go to subtextpodcast.com/rate. And for early, ad-free, and bonus episodes, please subscribe directly on Apple Podcasts or by going to patreon.com/subtextpodcast. Please send your questions, feedback, and episode requests to letters@subtextpodcast.com. If we get enough questions, we'll do some bonus Q&A shows for subscribers. You can also find us on Facebook at Subtext Podcast and on Twitter at Enjoy Subtext.
Ever tried reading while jogging, cooking, or even juggling flaming torches? Yeah, doesn't end well. But with audiobooks.com, you can conquer books without the circus act. Dive into over 450,000 titles, including more than 10,000 free ones. Get hooked on a bestseller. Find your next obsession. Or finally read that classic you've been avoiding since high school. And here's the inside scoop. Sign up today for a free 30-day trial and snag your first 3 audiobooks on the house. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.